Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. My name is Julie Wright, and I am the Health Systems Program Manager with the New York State Department of Health's Bureau of Tobacco Control. The Tobacco Control Program has gone through a little metamorphosis, and we have transitioned from the Tobacco Cessation Centers to the Health Systems for a Tobacco-Free New York. Our Health Systems for a Tobacco-Free New York is engaging healthcare systems to improve the delivery of guideline-concordant care for tobacco dependents through systems and policy change at the organizational level. Healthcare organizations that serve disproportionately affected populations, those people with a low income, low educational attainment, and serious mental illness, remain the primary focus, as that was where we were seeing the greatest tobacco use disparities. Health systems contractors are working to expand the reach of evidence-based smoking cessation interventions without direct provision of those services. Contractors focus on higher-level administrative decision-makers to ensure that the providers and the health systems they oversee deliver appropriate and aggressive tobacco-dependent treatments to its member. Each county has a contractor available to assist your organization. At the conclusion of today's call, please complete the evaluation posted in the upper left corner of the New York State Smokers Quitline site where you access the materials and information for this call. If you would like to receive CASAC credits or a certificate of attendance, you must complete the evaluation. At this time, on behalf of the Health Systems for Tobacco-Free New York Collaborative Conference Call Workgroup, I would like to welcome you to today's call, Healthcare Systems Change to Identify and Treat Patients Who Use Tobacco, and introduce our esteemed presenter, Mr. Rob Assett. Mr. Assett is the Director of Education and Outreach Programs at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. He provides support and assistance with planning, implementation, and evaluating outreach programs, and has over 30 years' experience in community-based work. Rob, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Julie. So here's the three big areas I'm going to cover today. First, talking about healthcare reform components to help facilitate access to healthcare systems. Talk about some health systems change strategies, and then how do we implement those strategies in what we call the real world. So let's start with the components of the healthcare reform. And I like starting with this slide because this is really the nugget of, I believe, what you invited me today to speak about. And if you're trying to gain access to a healthcare system or an individual clinic or hospital, if you offer to help them meet their tobacco use identification and treatment goals for any of the healthcare delivery and payment reform programs I'm about to talk about, they will definitely listen. Healthcare right now is completely focused on these things that I'm going to mention in the next few slides, and they welcome help around the tobacco cessation pieces of it. So first, the biggie is the Affordable Care Act, and these are some of the kind of major goals of the Affordable Care Act, and really it's about better care, smarter or lower spending, and healthier people is the ultimate outcome. The philosophy is very much about rewarding value rather than volume, and another way to say that is that healthcare provider reimbursement is based on the quality of care rather than the quantity of care. So the health of the population of patients that they serve is more important than the sheer number of tests and exams and that kind of thing that get performed on that population. So a fairly dramatic shift in healthcare. And then the other piece of the big piece of the Affordable Care Act is improving the availability of information to guide clinical decision making, and that's almost all focused on the electronic health record and how that can be used to not only guide clinical decision making, but then the care that is delivered to patients. So in the Affordable Care Act, tobacco cessation does play a prominent role. One of the reasons is people know and understand that it greatly affects the health of the patients that they're seeing. And another reason is that all the United States Preventive Services Task Force, that's what the USPSTF stands for, all of their A and B preventive services, which includes tobacco cessation, which is an A, has to be provided without cost to the patient. And another piece is that health insurance premiums for tobacco users can be up to 1.5 times the rate for non-tobacco users. There are a list of essential health benefits that all qualified health plans must include these 10 essential health benefits, and tobacco cessation treatment is one of those. It also forbids the exclusion of FDA-approved smoking cessation meds, and that includes the over-the-counter medications. So none of the 7 FDA-approved medications for tobacco cessation can be excluded in coverage. And then the coverage for tobacco cessation treatment for pregnant Medicaid members is another requirement. So what does the Affordable Care Act say about tobacco cessation treatment? They issued in May of 2014, so about a year ago, HHS issued this guidance to insurers and health plans on tobacco cessation under the Affordable Care Act. Many of you have probably already seen this. A health plan or insurance has to provide without cost sharing or without prior authorization screening of all patients for tobacco use, and for those who use tobacco products, at least 2 quit attempts per year, with coverage for each of those quit attempts to include at least four counseling sessions of at least 10 minutes, and that includes telephone, group, and individual counseling, and then any of the 7 FDA-approved tobacco cessation medications for up to a 90-day treatment regimen, and again, that's for each quit attempt. So it's fairly clear. It wasn't clearly defined like this at the beginning. This guidance has helped, I think, clearly lay out what is expected for coverage and provision of treatment around tobacco cessation. So another giant driver right now is an incentive program called the Meaningful Use of Electronic Health Records, and this offers incentives and penalties that encourage hospitals, practices, and community health centers to implement and utilize the meaningful use of electronic health records. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what that means in the next couple of slides. So why does meaningful use matter? It's the standard that doctors and hospitals must achieve to qualify for these incentive payments, and I'm going to talk on a slide or two about the size of these incentive payments. It's also the federal government, so Federal Health and Human Services and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to federal agencies. It's really their roadmap of what they see and want for health information technology. And that includes exchanging information electronically across systems with patients. It's also right now the major influencer on the activities of healthcare and EHR vendors. And it's definitely the primary consideration as EHR vendors upgrade their products and their software. So here's a brief overview of the three stages of meaningful use. And stage three is going to be the proposed stage three rule is just closing per public comment. And the final rule will be issued at some point later this year or early 2016. And stage three then takes effect January 1st of 2017. But basically, these are the tobacco cessation pieces. You'll notice right here that recording the smoking status for patients 13 years and older is a required piece. They must do this, and that's in both stage one and stage two. The difference between one and two is that in stage one, it's required to be on more than 50% of all their patients, and in stage two, it's more than 80% of all their patients. And then finally, for stage three, what's proposed is that smoking status will still be required, but it won't have to be reported on for a testing for meaningful use. And there's a new piece that's being proposed for stage three, and that's a clinical quality measure, which they're recommending for physicians. And it's there at the end, closing the referral loop, receipt of specialist report. And that will play heavily into our work that I'll talk about in a bit, about electronically referring patients to our state tobacco quit line directly from the electronic health record. And then at the bottom are the clinical quality measures that apply across all three stages. Tobacco is one of the nine that are recommended for eligible professionals, which are the physicians, and there is no tobacco clinical quality measure for hospitals. And you can see here at the bottom that it's for patients 18 and older, the screening for tobacco use one or more times, and that they received cessation counseling intervention if identified as a tobacco user. So as I mentioned earlier, this is a huge economic incentive program. You can see here that as of almost a year ago, about 92% of the hospitals in the United States are participating in the Meaningful Use Incentive Program, and about three-quarters of the eligible professionals are participating. So it's by far the majority of people that are participating in healthcare in this incentive program, and it's really driven the adoption and implementation of health information technology over the last 5 or 6 years. So to give you a sense of why this is such a big deal, an individual physician through the various stages of meaningful use can earn up to about $44,000. The total physician payments to date are almost $10 billion with a B dollars. And so that's again, why so many people are participating. And the benefit is that EHRs and health information technology have been adopted and advanced much more quickly than they have in the past. I didn't put it on here, but an individual hospital can earn up to approximately $2 million per hospital. And you can see there about $15 billion have been paid out to hospitals through about a year ago, July 14. So again, huge driver of change. And going back to what I said earlier, all of these pieces I'm talking about, if we figure out ways to help a system meet these different healthcare delivery and quality performance goals around tobacco, they will definitely listen and invite our help. So next, switching over to the inpatient side, the Joint Commission, they have a new performance measure set for tobacco cessation, and the Joint Commission accredits about 95% of the hospitals in the United States on a variety of performance measures, one of which is tobacco cessation. So here's the new performance measure set around tobacco. It went into effect January 1st of 2012. It's screening for tobacco use. The second one is providing treatment, which specifically includes counseling and medication during the hospitalization. And then the third part of it is treatment management plan at discharge. So what will happen with the patient who's been tobacco-free while they've been hospitalized. And then the fourth one I've crossed out, actually. That has been, as you can see, that's a post-hospitalization patient follow-up, and that's actually been indefinitely suspended by the Joint Commission. So the first three are what make up the performance measure set for tobacco. All right, then the last piece I'm going to talk about is a CMS program. So again, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, a federal program. It's called Inpatient Prospective Payment System, or IPPS. And basically, it's a quality reporting program, which CMS incentivizes compliance with key performance measures. And they do that by withholding a proportion of Medicare payments back to the hospital in this case, because it's inpatient. Fortunately, great for healthcare, CMS did adopt compliance with the first two of the Joint Commission tobacco performance measures, and they're considering adding that third one, so a treatment plan made at discharge. And that was for psychiatric hospitals. I'm sorry, that's a very important distinction. So not general acute care hospitals, but for psychiatric hospitals. So that's advancing well. And then CMS is considering adding compliance with the first two Joint Commission tobacco measures as part of the inpatient prospective payment system for general hospitals. So again, that will be great if and when that happens, because it becomes tied to their federal reimbursement. So that's a real motivator. All right, so those are kind of the big picture items around healthcare reform. And I want to switch now to talking about strategies for health systems change. So any of you that have worked or work in healthcare systems know these first pieces. Healthcare systems and settings are very busy. They're chaotic. It's hard to get an initiative going in healthcare because they're so overwhelmed. Another factor is that patients almost never, so rarely, present for tobacco cessation. So the first priority for the provider during that visit is to address the health concerns that brought the patient to the clinic. So how do we help them also integrate tobacco cessation treatment for any of their patients who are using tobacco? And again, as I said at the beginning of the webinar, how you can help the provider or system achieve one or more of those tobacco performance goals that we spoke about earlier, that will be key to helping you gain access. So some strategies that we've used here in the state of Wisconsin, and I work for the University of Wisconsin Center for Tobacco Research and Intervention, and we're primarily a research center, but in 2000, Dr. Michael Fiore, who's the director of our center, created the part of our center which I direct, and that's really, it's about taking the research and working with clinics and hospitals and healthcare systems to implement that evidence into everyday clinical practice. Our goal is always to have evidence-based tobacco dependence treatment become the standard of care for any patient that walks into that healthcare setting. Quite often we hear clinicians say to us, that's all great, but I've got a patient this afternoon, what do I do? So that what we focus on with through our academic detailing is very tailored and precise to that setting. There aren't many canned things that we, deliver or make available to them. We really try to tailor it to their specific setting and needs. Academic detailing in our case typically starts with training, but then very quickly transition over to the technical assistance. And as I just mentioned, that's the how-to. Most people these days know why smoking and tobacco use is bad, but what clinicians need help with and systems need help with is the how to treat their patients who use tobacco. Sometimes offering CME or CE credit is a draw for people. We've developed a whole set of brief, concise resources and tools, and they're all available at this web address here at the bottom. And the last bullet of my slide I see got bumped down. But basically it says the other piece of our academic detailing is to integrate the state tobacco quitline into the clinical care as a treatment extender. And we're always conscious of talking about it as a treatment extender, not a replacement for that clinical intervention. Another key strategy, and I'm gonna talk about a few of key strategies over the next three or four slides. And again, these are strategies that not only will get you in the door, but also help the system really integrate these changes that we're talking about. So probably the primary one is we use a champion. If we can identify a champion within a healthcare system, that always is beneficial. And I encourage you to think broadly, think about the different roles that are listed on the slide here. So it doesn't have to be a physician. It really can be anybody within that system that's passionate about tobacco cessation. Another strategy that we've used fairly successfully is becoming part of, so a sitting member of a healthcare system's tobacco cessation work group. So if you're talking with a healthcare system, find out from them, do they have a team or a work group focused on tobacco cessation? And or would they think it would be beneficial to form one? And then, obviously ask if you can be an ongoing member of that. What it does is it really allows you to be there as a resource and kind of the first resource that they can turn to for information and training and technical assistance, tools, that kind of thing. So an incredibly important one, and this is important across almost all the work we do and I guess work anybody does, and that's about the relationships that we've built and continue to build. We really look at fostering a working relationship with individual staff in a system. And again, primarily the ones that are interested in or already doing tobacco cessation. What that allows us to do is really become the go-to people. So we really become the resource for that system or those clinicians. And they kind of contact us first or go to our website first. So that's been a really important strategy that we've used over the years. And the relationship building completely turns into referrals. So what I mean by that is people that we've worked with in one system or at one site, one clinic, they often tell their colleagues about us. And so that's led to referral work, I call it, where people reach out to us. We're not even reaching out to them. So that's been a nice piece over the years to develop and maintain. And then I think this is the last strategy, to work with professional associations. So contact any health-related professional association in your state or, you know, your region, and find out if you can talk with them about evidence-based tobacco dependence treatment and the resources that you could bring. And again, this has always been a collaborative thing with us. We've always worked in collaboration with these big systems or associations, and you can see them listed at the bottom of the slide there. And often it's developing a resource together where it's co-branded. It has the association logo and our logo. The association distributes it throughout their members. And often then we provide a webinar kind of, hey, here's an introduction to a new resource. And we're available to come on site and provide training and technical assistance. So that's been a successful strategy that we've used over the years as well. So I want to end my presentation today with a few very specific examples of the healthcare systems work that we've done and are continue to do in Wisconsin. This is kind of, how do we put this into practice, these strategies that we've just discussed. And examples of our work include primary care, hospitals, mental health and substance abuse treatment, and our working with our state Medicaid program. And on the slide is a link here. We actually developed two booklets of case studies around systems change. And I encourage you to visit the link and take a look at them, because they include in much more detail what I'm going to talk about over the next couple of minutes about very specific and detailed health systems and how they worked, and in all cases we worked with them to implement and sustain evidence-based tobacco dependence treatment across and throughout their system. So again, I encourage you to visit the website and take a look at those. They're easy to read, and as I said, they give complete detail around what I'm going to talk about over the next couple of minutes. So first up is primary care, and this is really our major focus area. It's really where we want and do spend a lot of our time. And you might ask why, and it's because 70% of people who use tobacco want to quit, and also 70% of patients who use tobacco visit a primary care clinician annually. And unfortunately, of those patients who use tobacco and visit primary care, only about a quarter of them leave with an evidence-based tobacco dependence treatment intervention. And so there's just a huge missed opportunity day in and day out across the primary care clinics in the country. So we really want to change that and capitalize on those patients who are using tobacco and are visiting their primary care. So we, as I said a little earlier, we really, our goal is to make evidence-based tobacco cessation the standard of care. So any patient that walks through that door, their tobacco use is identified and documented. And again, that's a place meaningful use has really helped 99% of the healthcare providers are now asking about and documenting tobacco use. That was one of the requirements of meaningful use. So that's really driven that into almost universal thing that happens. And all the EHR vendors have incorporated that as a core piece of EHR software. The other piece that we focus a lot on is integrating the Wisconsin Tobacco Quitline, as I said earlier, as a treatment extender into primary care. And that's really about training clinical staff and hospital staff and mental health and substance abuse providers around this brief intervention that comes from the 2008 clinical practice guideline, and then giving them the state tobacco quitline as a resource so their patient can get more in-depth services and support. We know they can't provide, in primary care especially, in a 15-minute patient visit, they can't provide in-depth counseling. So we always talk about integrating our state quitline into their care and into their tobacco cessation treatment workflow. And then a big piece of what we've done in the last 5 or 6 years is integrating both the 5A brief intervention, which, as I just mentioned, comes out of the clinical practice guideline, and then creating a completely electronic closed-loop referral to our quitline. So patients are referred to the quitline directly from the electronic health record. And then, importantly, the quitline service data for that individual patient is sent back to that patient's electronic health record, including any counseling they received and any medications, populate the patient's medication list right in their record with a start and an end date. So, again, to make it as easy and convenient for healthcare as possible. And we also know that in the electronic health record world, more and more clinicians are not going to go outside the electronic health record to do something. So this piece of paper and the fax machine that we currently have for our fax referral program to the quitline is quickly becoming obsolete. So next, a bit about our work with hospitals. Specifics, again, a big thing that we did is partner with our Wisconsin Hospital Association, and we developed a toolkit for hospitals. It's available on our website at the link there. And this was a process of we had a relationship with our State Hospital Association. And when the new guideline came out, and then when the Joint Commission measures for tobacco were updated in 2012, we went to them, and they were happy to work with us. Their role really was kind of reviewing. We created the content, and the Hospital Association kind of reviewed the content and the format. The Hospital Association also provided the webinar technology and, of course, access to their members and encouragement of their members to engage in tobacco cessation and to utilize our center's staff for training and technical assistance. And then, as I said, we created the content. We shared the toolkit via a webinar, and then we did many, many on-site follow-up training and technical assistance sessions with individual hospitals and even with departments within hospitals if the whole hospital wasn't interested. So the final piece that I'll talk about, again, for the probably the last 7 or 8 years, we've increasingly been working with mental health and substance abuse providers. I think everyone on the call knows that people with mental illness or substance abuse diagnosis smoke at much higher rates than the general adult population. And we've got a program here called the Wisconsin Nicotine Treatment Integration Project, or WINTIP. And it really is about reaching out to mental health and substance abuse treatment providers and doing basically what we do in primary care, offering them on-site training and technical assistance. Often it's we start with kind of a baseline assessment to see what, if anything, they're currently doing to identify tobacco use and intervene with their patients who use tobacco. The beauty of behavioral health is these providers have way more time with their patients than primary care. So in primary care, it's typically a 15-minute visit. In a hospital, you know, maybe it's a quick bedside consult. But in the case of substance abuse and mental health providers, they typically have 50-minute sessions, you know, over a period of time with these patients. So it really lends itself to tobacco cessation intervention and then them providing support through a quit attempt. We partnered with our state Bureau of Mental Health and our state Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. They've been intimately involved from the very beginning and help, again, with access to their members and encouragement of their members to take advantage of the training and technical assistance that we can provide, and also just getting word out about the increased use of tobacco products by people in these populations and why it's so important to help them quit. Again, as with most everything, we have some resources available. There are a few toolkits available at the link there at the bottom. And everything on our website is public domain, so feel free to use and take whatever works for you, which leads me right to this slide. So I encourage you to visit our website. We have many, many resources there. There's a whole healthcare providers section where we've developed fact sheets and quick little how-to pieces and resources for clinicians because, again, we continue to hear that one, they don't have a lot of time, and two, they don't know what to do. So almost all of our resources are around that. So in addition to these fact sheets and toolkits, we've got also a lot of archived webinars. We've got some videos, patient case studies, and as I said, all of the information on our website is free and public domain, so feel free to use whatever is helpful for you. And I would just end by saying that all of our information is based on the 2008 clinical practice guideline, treating tobacco use and dependence. So it's steeped in the evidence. And the evidence around tobacco cessation, as I'm sure you all know, is deep and strong. So that's what we stand on. And then finally, I'll end. Here's my email address if people have follow-up kinds of things. And I think at this time, Wes, we're going to open it up for questions and answer and discussion.
Okay, so and, the floor is Wes, before we do that, this is Pat Bax. I'm the Marketing and Outreach Coordinator with the New York State Smokers Quitline. And before we open it up for questions, I just want to mention that our chat is open if you would like to chat in a question. We have a couple questions coming in. If we do not get to all the questions, we will have responses from Rob at that to the chat questions, and those will be posted on our Quit site for you to peruse. And I just want to thank you, Rob, before we take questions, for your excellent and very informative presentation as well as the resources. You've certainly given us in New York State some wonderful ideas and suggestions with implementing any kind of health systems change in various agencies. I also do want to welcome our new and returning participants joining us today. Just a gentle reminder that the New York State Smokers Quit Line here at Roswell Park Cancer Institute in sunny Buffalo is available statewide to assist you in helping your clients or your patients not only become but stay tobacco-free. And we do provide free evidence-based cessation services and resources. Rob mentioned several times about the importance of that evidence-based intervention. And our quit coaches provide support and assistance to your patients as they make successful quit attempts. And tobacco users can call the quit line directly. They can register for nicotine replacement therapy online, or they can be referred directly through a provider referral. And we do offer free motivational coaching to New York State residents, a two-week starter kit of patches, ongoing support, an array of resources, as you can see on our website, access to social media, text messaging, and our online smoke-free community. And as providers, I strongly encourage you to explore our website at nysmokefree.com for valuable, ready-to-use tools such as our referral program and downloadable materials such as our fact sheets on chronic diseases. And remember, as Rob mentioned, the quit line is really a treatment extender. And the resources we can provide, as well as the resources Rob mentioned from the University of Wisconsin, are all available to help you in making systems change. And if you're interested in New York State and learning about our referral process, including our policy-driven, system-wide opt-to-quit program that is advancing across the state, please contact us directly at 1-866-697-8487 for more information. And on behalf of the New York State Smokers Quit Line, thank you for referring your patients. We look forward to assisting you with cessation policy and systems change. And at this time, we will open it up for questions.
Okay, certainly the floor is now open for your questions. If you have a question or comment, please press 7 on your telephone keypad. Okay, the first question comes from Sarah Pearl. Sarah, the floor is yours.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much, Rob. That was really terrific. I actually have 4 questions. I'm just going to throw them all out there, and then you can ask them, you can answer them as time suits you. The first question that we had was about the May 2nd, 2014 Department of Labor guidance around the ACA requirements. The question is really, like, when is that effective? In other words, you know, when can we go back to the plans and say you're not compliant at this point? So that's my first question. My second question is about meaningful use and its application to mental health and behavioral health settings. My third question is a little bit more complicated, so I'm going to leave it alone for the moment. And I'll go to my fourth question, which is about your website, which has all sorts of fantastic information on it. I've been there a lot. I'm curious if maybe you can point us to maybe what's new.
All right. All great questions, Sarah. The May 2nd of 2014 guidance from the Department of Labor and the Department of Health and Human Services was effective actually at the beginning of the Affordable Care Act, so a long time ago. So it's in effect now for sure. It was in effect the day that was released, and it was in essence in effect prior to that. So definitely it's something that you can use with your health plans and insurers. So I'd say go for it. It's a great leverage tool. The meaningful use of electronic health records does not currently apply to mental health or behavioral health providers. for whatever reasons, they weren't included in this. And anecdotally, because of that, electronic health record adoption has been much slower in that field. And then resources on our website, that's our new resources. That's hard. Because our resources are electronic, we're constantly updating them so that we keep them up to date. So if there are changes in medications or treatment protocols or any of that kind of stuff, we update them. So it's difficult for me to kind of point out specifically new ones. I would say the most popular ones are definitely our archived webinars, as well as our case studies and kind of video training pieces. So I don't know if that answers your question specifically, but it would be difficult for me to point out newer recent resources because we're kind of constantly updating all of them.
That's extremely helpful.
The next question comes from Rose Little. Rose, the floor is yours. Rose, if your phone is muted, please unmute your phone.
Sorry, can you guys hear me okay?
Yes.
Hi. I have two questions for you, Rob. I understand that the program itself, we're very, I'm very new to this, and your counselors actually walk through patients who are insured about what options they may have with their insurance. I was wondering if that kind of information was published within, like, any of the resources on your website so that maybe we can advertise it that way, that if you have Medicaid, these are some replacement therapies that they will cover. It actually will provide a little more guidance to our providers that may have patients on the fence about having somebody contact them from the hotline and maybe just want to try something on their own. But we always have trouble when it comes to prescribing like some sort of medication or maybe even nicotine patches when it comes to insurance companies.
Yeah, that's a great question and very complicated. We have information on our website about Wisconsin Medicaid, but that varies from state to state. So what's available in Wisconsin for Medicaid members for tobacco cessation might not be exactly the same. I am guessing it will not be exactly the same. So I encourage you to check with your state Medicaid program.
Okay.
And then as far as commercial or private insurance, that varies much from plan to plan. But what I would do is use that May 2014 guidance as that's what should be covered for everybody.
Okay, I understand. It's just insurance companies, we find ourselves not fighting with them, but we have to do a lot of prior authorizations for patients that may want to start like a medication, like a Chantix. Except what ends up happening is that they want the patient on like a nicotine replacement therapy, such as like a patch, for X amount of time prior. But we would have just initially given the prescription for a nicotine patch had we known that they would have covered it in the first place.
Yeah. Again, that's, I understand the challenge for sure. But in that guidance, it's very clear that there can be no prior auths and there can be no cost to the patient. So I would use all that as leverage to work with insurance companies and the providers. Now, from individual patient, definitely a struggle. And then in healthcare, in primary care, for example, they don't know what is covered for an individual patient. So that's,
I understand.
That's definitely a challenge that we continue to work on for sure.
Great. My second question is that you guys have like a really great online forum, and I had actually already spoken to Pat about this. I was asking if you guys are going to come out with an app soon, and she said that it's in works. Do you guys actually have any community outreach, like face to face, events where like patients can come and maybe they just need to put a face to the program and have like trainers or counselors that may or may not be able to come to like a, maybe a health fair to maybe advertise these smoking cessation programs.
Yeah, great question. We made a decision, since we only have four staff that cover the whole state of Wisconsin, to not do that kind of thing because the payoff is usually fairly low. We get requests for that all the time, and what we do is provide tobacco quitline promotional materials for those events.
Mm-hmm.
And we stay then focused on the health side because we have a bigger impact than individually to people who use tobacco.
Got it. And you guys offer the OptiQuit pamphlet in an alternate language, right?
That's a Pat back.
Hi, this is Pat. Yeah, we do currently have the OptiQuit brochure, the patient brochure, in English and Spanish.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, guys.
You're welcome. Thanks for the questions.
Again, as a reminder for a question or comment, please press 7 on your telephone keypad. And the next question comes from Sarah Pearl. Sarah, the floor is yours.
Hi, it's Sarah again. I figured if nobody was going to ask a question, I'd go back to my unasked third question. So my third question is essentially about what you mean by treatment extender for the quit line. So one of the things that we're kind of, grappling with in New York is this idea of, you know, whether or not we want to try to get our providers to provide the services or we want to allow them to refer to the quit line. And we'd rather it not be an either-or situation. We think maybe that there's a role for both, that the provider needs to RX and that the quit line can then come in and provide some of the services around counseling and around maybe motivational interviewing. But that's only going to work if the patient gets back to the doctor, which New York State is set up to do. We have a terrific OptiQuit program where they inform the doctor that the patient has called the quit line and the services that have been provided. But we then need the doctor to kind of resume care because maybe that patient has had motivational interviewing and is now interested in an RX or is now interested in quitting. You know, is that something that you guys have thought about, Rob, about sort of how to sort of think that, you know, that essentially tobacco cessation, it really is management of a chronic disease. We really need to look at it in a much more kind of long-term way about, especially the smokers that are continuing to smoke, they need more care. They need a different kind of care potentially. And that, you know, to have them sort of come in and out of care with the provider, with the quit line, you know, with whatever resources are available to us might be a more sort of appropriate model at this stage?
Yeah, very well said, Sarah. We think about that all the time. So anytime we're talking with an individual clinician or site or system, when we speak about, in our case, the Wisconsin Tobacco Quit Line, as I said, we always talk about it as a treatment extender, not a replacement for the clinical treatment. It's for the very reasons you said. We only offer 2 weeks nicotine replacement therapy through our quit line, and that's not a full course. So we need the healthcare provider to write a script for the med, and we also say that the clinician, even a minute or two discussion about quitting is motivational for their patients. And then a really important point you made at the end of, they don't just turn their patient over to the quit line. This is like referring my patient to any other service or specialty that I would refer them to. I don't give that patient up. That patient is still mine, and I follow up with them. That's a struggle. Some places do it better than others, but that's kind of what we always preach, that you're not just turning your patient over to the quit line and everything will be solved. It's still your patient. We need you to do the medication piece, and we need you to follow the patient through their quit attempt and keep supporting them.
And thank you at this time. There are no further questions.
Thank you, Wes. This is Pat. I just want to mention a couple questions coming in about the presentation availability, the slides, and a black and white copy of the handout of the slides available for printing are available on our website at nysmokefree.com, where you obtain the information for the call and the web link. Also, the recording will be posted within a week. We do ask that if you are looking to receive KFAT credits or you would like a certificate of attendance, our evaluation can also be found at nysmokefree.com. We ask that you follow the directions on the evaluation. It is posted underneath the presentation PowerPoint and the slide handout. At this time, I also want to remind you that it is important to complete that evaluation or you will not receive KFAT credits. We do ask that you complete it within 1 week. I'd like to turn this back to Julie to have any closing remarks. And thank you all for participating on our call today.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Rob. It was a great conversation. I'm so excited that people were able to join in and ask questions. Please feel free to reach out to us for additional ones. Just a quick reminder for those of you that have a health system that's looking for additional support, there is a health systems contractor within your catchment area, and that information is available on the New York State's Department of Health Bureau of Tobacco Control's webpage, where you can find a contact email and phone number to help assist you and your organization. So thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. We look forward to future collaborative conference calls, so please be on the lookout for new and exciting topics that will be coming your way. Thank you so much, everyone, and have a great day.